From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. In 1969, tens of thousands of coal miners took to the streets demanding safer working conditions. The demonstrations led to tighter federal regulations and compensation to miners who contracted black lung, a disease caused by breathing toxic mine dust. Cases of black lung plummeted, but turns out the dip was only temporary. A new investigation by NPR and the Center for Public Integrity has discovered that the number of cases of black lung is up, way up. And the disease is affecting miners from Virginia to Utah. Today on the program, we'll hear more about the investigative report and just why black lung is on the rise. Plus, a conversation with Jay Henderson, this month's featured artist on Sounds from the Lounge. All that and your calls after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Thanks to tighter federal rules on mine dust exposure, experts thought black lung was a thing of the past. But a new investigation by NPR and the Center for Public Integrity shows a resurgence of the disease among coal miners across the country, including here in Utah. Today on the program, we'll hear more about just why doctors are seeing so many new cases and how the mining industry is skirting the rules. Joining us in studio, Howard Berkus. He is the rural affairs correspondent for NPR. He's covered everything from seven Olympic Games, Hurricane Katrina, public lands issues, and of course, mine safety. He's based here in Salt Lake City, and he joins me in studio. Howard, great to have you. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Chris Hamby. He is a staff writer for iWatchNews.org at the Center for Public Integrity. It's a nonpartisan news organization dedicated to investigative reporting. And Chris joins us from NPR in Washington. Chris, good morning.
Thanks for having me.
Later on in the program, we turn to a local singer-songwriter, Jay Henderson. But first, the NPR CPI investigation, Black Lung Returns to Coal Country. There are links on our website, kcpw.org. What more do you think mines should be doing to protect their employees? If you've got questions or comments about mine safety or the experience, have experience in the mines here in Utah, you can give us a call, 801-355. Talk is our number, 801-355-8255. Howard, I want to start with you. You've been working on mine safety issues, reporting for years now. What got you started on this path of uncovering the disturbing numbers of cases of black lung?
Well, part of what I've been doing now for 2 years is reporting on the aftermath of the Upper Big Branch coal mine explosion in West Virginia. And a year ago, a report came out by independent investigator Davitt McAteer, a former federal mine safety chief, on that explosion, the causes of it. And a footnote to the report was a review of the autopsies of the 29 victims of that disaster. 24 of them had enough lung tissue for testing. 71% of those 24 had indications of black lung. Some of them were, two of them were in their 20s. Had only 10 years experience underground. And this was a really shocking development to people in the black lung field, who have been charting an increase in black lung since really the mid-1990s. But for such a huge percentage of people and such young, you know, so many young miners in a coal mine to have black lung show up in this way was really shocking. By the way, that 71%, black lung rate in southern West Virginia, where this mine is 10 times less than that. So it was a really shocking result. And Chris Hamby at the Center for Public Integrity and I had talked about doing some stories anyway. And at that time, Chris wrote a story about this increase in black lung. And we started talking about digging into that deeper. And that's what we've been doing now for the last few months.
Chris, is that what the red flag was for you, this shocking statistic coming out of the autopsies from the Upper Big Branch mine? You had worked with Howard before on a series on air pollution. I mean, is that kind of the kernel that got you thinking there's more here?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, really, what came out of Upper Big Branch was shocking, just the numbers that Howard just described. But We were interested. I mean, we always had the sense that there was more of a story there, and we really wanted to get into why this was happening. And I mean, this was a disease that was supposed to have been eradicated, you know, years ago, decades ago, potentially. This is something that you typically think of as a, you know, an old coal miner's disease, an old man's disease, and they're finding that that's simply not the case anymore.
Before we get into some of the details of your investigation, Howard, in your story, you quote an epidemiologist who says that new black lung cases are a public health epidemic.
Yeah.
How many cases are we talking about?
That number, that you can't pin down a firm number because not every coal miner is tested. Testing is voluntary. They've tested about 43% of the nation's coal miners. And it is that testing by which they base this notion that there's an epidemic. The percentage of people who are tested who come up with black lung indications, to them, you know, that's where they say there's an epidemic. You know, and through that testing, which has been done since the 1970s, they find that occurrences of black lung now have doubled, and that cases of the worst stages of the disease have quadrupled since the 1980s. So even though there was, as you mentioned, there was a steep decline in black lung after the enactment of laws in 1969 to control coal mine dust, dropped, you know, 90%. The last 15 years or so, it's been rising. We do know that there are about 9,000 to 10,000 people now who have black lung. That includes working and retired miners. This is according to the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health. And that's a projection based on the percentages they find for the numbers of miners who have actually been tested.
Mm. Speaking with NPR's Howard Berkus, also Chris Hamby with the Center for Public Integrity, they have issued a joint investigative report. You can find links on our website, kcpw.org, about a disturbing trend, an uptick in the number of black lung cases across the country. If you have questions about this investigative report, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Chris Hamby, give us a primer on black lung. What exactly is it? How does it affect a body?
Well, it's the doctor at NIOSH, he consults for NIOSH, and he's also a clinician who treats
and NIOSH
a lot of these patients.
Is...
The National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health that Howard just mentioned. And they're the government agency that's really been doing the research on this, that's at the forefront of this, described it, and I quoted as him, and I think Howard did as well, as calling it a diabolical torture, really, to die from black lung. It's slowly, there's all this dust that's called respirable dust that's ground up in the process of mining the coal and also cutting through the rock to get to the coal. Miners breathe this in, and some of it can work its way out of the lung naturally, but increasingly it is, with longer work hours, it collects in miners' lungs, and you start to get lesions, over time the lung literally becomes black and shriveled up and scarred, and eventually you're struggling for every breath in the last stage, and you know, you're afraid to fall asleep. You have to sleep sitting up. Sometimes you don't want to eat. It's really, as the doctor said, a diabolical torture.
And there's just this horrible graphic, I have to say, on NPR.org. There are links on our website, kcpw.org. Howard, I mean, comparing the healthy lung to the black lung. It's striking.
It looks like a paper bag that you set on fire, and the remains are this kind of charred. It looks charred and shriveled. And you can imagine trying to get a breath into that lung. There's nothing to get a breath into. It's so difficult. That same doctor who Chris just mentioned, Dr. Lee Petsonk, from West Virginia University and NIOSH, described it as like taking a screw and slowly turning it in your throat. Day after day, year after year, you lose more and more breath. It's much, much more difficult to breathe.
that tightening sensation. I want to play a clip from your story, your first segment, Howard, in the series. This is a man, a black lung patient named Mark McCowan. I want to play this clip and then maybe have you introduce us to him.
Now it feels like I've got a heavy, wet sack on each lung. Breathing has become a conscious effort. Some days I'm consciously feeling how heavy my lungs are and that it's not getting no better. It seems like I give a little bit up of my world each day, that it gets smaller and smaller.
And it, later on in the piece, I mean, he talks about how this feels like he's conquering Everest every single day. I mean, just that labored breathing. Tell us about Mark McCowan.
Mark McCowan is 47 now. He lives in Pounding Mill, Virginia. To sit with him in his living room, as Chris and I did, and chat with him for a couple of hours, he looks healthy. There's no outward sign that there's anything wrong with him, but you heard it in his labored breathing. And he talks about how he can't mow the lawn anymore. He can't walk the small hill in his yard. He can't hold his two-year-old grandson without getting completely out of breath, and he has to put him down. And his grandson, you know, says to him, you know, run, Papa, run, because he likes to run now. And Mark says, I can't, you know, I can't, little fella, I can't do that anymore. And Mark is unfortunately a kind of classic example of what has happened now in the last 15 years. He was he got a clean X-ray when he got a new job in a coal mine when he was about 35. Then he was tested at age 40, and he was diagnosed with progressive massive fibrosis, the most serious stage of black lung. So that's 5 years. He went from what seems like no disease to the worst stage of disease. That's one new thing that's going on here. It's progressing much more quickly. And since then, it has progressed from the first stage of the worst stage to the worst stage of the worst stage. In 5 years, it went to that. And now at 47, he doesn't know how long he'll live. He doesn't know whether he will live long enough for his two-year-old grandson to develop a memory of him. And that's one of the things he keeps hoping for, that he can stay alive long enough that his grandson will have a memory of him.
Hmm. In your piece in iWatch News, Chris Hamby, you introduced us to a man with a similar story, Ray Markham, a man who worked in a West Virginia coal mine for 30 years. And you talk about the legacy of black lung in his family. Tell us their story.
Yeah, the Markhams are a family from eastern Kentucky, and Ray is the patriarch. He's now 83, and he's been drawing black lung benefits for about 30 years. And he worked in the mines in a different era. This was before the 1969 law took effect that set the first limits on the dust that causes black lung. And so the dust levels were extremely high. Men who had worked about at least 25 years in the mines like he did, there was about a 45% rate of them actually got the disease. So it was an incredible problem. And, you know, there were the wildcat strikes in West Virginia and calls for reform, and everything was supposed to have changed in 1969. And we were supposed to see this decline, and we have seen a drastic decline. But what Ray Markham has seen is that the promise of the 1969 law has gone unfulfilled, because all three of his living sons have black lung, including one who's 51 who has the complicated form, the worst form that Howard was just describing. He's already had 8 pieces of his lung removed and studied in biopsies. His younger brother, by 1 year, has the simpler form of the disease, but is already at the worst stage. At age 50, his doctor is already talking about hooking him up to an oxygen tank. And then there's the third brother who has not as severe a case. But really, the thing that we heard over and over again, and from the doctor who diagnosed these men, is that this should not be. These three men, there should not be men with lungs like the three Markham brothers.
As you write, as you put it, men with lungs like the Markhams are not supposed to exist. So I want to go to one of the doctors that you introduce us to in your series, Dr. Donald Rasmussen. Tell us a little bit about Dr. Rasmussen and his work with black lung patients. Howard Berkus?
He, by the way, he studied medicine at the University of Utah and lived in Salt Lake City and went to West Virginia in the 1960s, I believe it was. And
so he's been practicing a long time.
He says he has treated 40,000 black lung patients in West Virginia. He's become probably the world's most experienced clinician when it comes to black lung. He still operates a black lung clinic in Beckley, West Virginia. And he thought that he would have been retired by now, but he's still testing minors. He said in 1969, I thought that we would eradicate this disease before we ever really understood it. And he said I was dead wrong. You know, he just he really thought he was one of the people who fought hard for those protections. And he really thought that they were going to make a huge difference, which they did for a while. But he, like other clinicians and pulmonologists, found that black lung was coming back.
Speaking with Howard Berkus from NPR, the Rural Affairs Correspondent, and also Chris Hamby, a staff writer for iWatchNews.org at the Center for Public Integrity, joining us from Washington. We're talking about their new investigative report, Black Lung Returns to Coal Country. There are links on our website, kcpw.org. But if you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. What do you want to know about measures meant to protect minors? We need to take a break, but we'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Good morning and welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. What was thought to be a vestige of coal mining's dirty past is back. Black lung, caused by exposure to mining dust, is now afflicting a new generation of miners, a disturbing trend uncovered by a recent investigation by NPR and the Center for Public Integrity. And today on the program, we're learning more about the investigation from the men behind it. And joining me in studio here in Salt Lake City, Howard Berkus, Rural Affairs Correspondent for NPR, and in NPR Washington studio, Chris Hamby, a staff writer for iWatchNews.org at the Center for Public Integrity. And you can find links to the NPR CPI investigative series, Black Lung Returns to Coal Country, on our website, kcpw.org. You can join us if you like. Do you know someone with a black lung? What more would you like to see done to prevent miners from contracting the disease? 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. I want to bring in another voice. But before we do that, actually, I have to get to the big question. So Why? What's going on here? Howard Berkus, why are we seeing such an increase in black lung cases?
There are a couple of things that, a number of things that are going on. First of all, miners are working longer hours. The average coal miner now works 600 more hours a year than in 1970. Coal production has been up significantly, and mining machines are much more efficient. Coal production was up five times by 2000, and even 2 years ago, it was still triple what it was from 1970. And the efficiency of mining machines means, as Chris mentioned, that you can cut more rock with coal. Coal seams, especially in Appalachia, are getting thinner. The best seams have already been mined. The thick seams have already been mined, and so they're mining thinner seams. And the geology in Appalachia is such that there's a lot of quartz mixed in with the coal seams. And so as they're cutting coal, they're also cutting rock, quartz, and quartz, when you cut it up, becomes silica. It's like crushed glass. And the combination of silica and coal dust is especially problematic. It's especially volatile, and that is believed to be one of the major causes of what is going on, is that miners are working longer, so they're exposed more often. Plus, they're breathing a more toxic mixture of coal dust and silica. And Chris did some data analysis in terms of numbers of violations that have taken place and what kind of monitoring actually occurs. So I'm going to hand it off to Chris to talk about that kind of information.
All right, Chris.
Yeah, well, just on the silica issue, as Howard mentioned, it's much more toxic for miners to breathe. And the Federal Mine Safety and Health Administration actually sets a limit. It's not supposed to compose more than 5% of the dust in the mine. But we obtained the dust sampling database from the agency and found that the average sample in each of the past 25 years has been higher than that limit. What's more is that limit is already twice what the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health said was safe in 1974 and recommended lowering the limit. And so that's the silica issue. On the dust issue, we again looked at the dust sampling data that we got from the agency and found that there have been, of the valid samples, a lot of samples are invalidated for various reasons, but of the valid samples that the agency had collected since 2000, going through 2011, about 53,000 showed that miners had been overexposed to dust, but the agency has issued only about 2,400 violations for overexposures to dust, and there are a number of reasons for that.
Oh, yeah, tell us why. I mean, why aren't they cracking down on these violations, first of all?
Well, this is really part and parcel of the way the system is structured. So when you submit a sample, IMSHA is determining whether you're in compliance with their rules for dust levels based on the average of 5 samples and not on 1 sample. So you could have one man who has a very, very high exposure, who is working right in the coal face, but then you get to average that with guys who are working other jobs that are not nearly as highly exposed. And so you can essentially negate those high samples of individual people and still be in compliance.
So you chop off the extremes on the ends and kind of go by what's in the middle?
Right. And the criticism of that is that you're leaving certain people with incredibly high exposures, which are the people who are actually running the machines that are cutting the coal and rock, and those are very often the people you see contracting this disease.
Mm. But, you know, one of the main points about that situation is that it's a way in which the law permits mining companies to underreport actual exposure. And it's one of the reasons that there's an increase in black lung is because we haven't had honest measurement of exposure in the 40 years that this law has been in effect. And the law gave, I call this the do-over. You know, the law gave a mining company the opportunity to go back and take these 5 samples when there's a violation, and that gives them the opportunity to, you know, to do it over and gives them a way of avoiding the violation. And as the numbers that Chris came up with show, you know, there are likely thousands and thousands and thousands of exposures that had violations and the violations were negated in this way.
Violations negated, miners spending more time in these concentrated toxic environments. You also point out that the numbers are tweaked in some ways. Yeah. That's a nice way of putting it. I want to bring a voice from your story in. This is Richard Allen, who, tell us about him. He's a former inspector.
He was an underground federal mine inspector when the law first took effect. And he talks about this situation in which he was talking to an investigator who had a very unusual sample of coal dust that he was looking at.
Richard Allen was a federal mine inspector underground in West Virginia when the new law first took effect. He remembers a strange question about a mine official's office, which revealed bogus sampling for coal dust.
What color is the man's carpet? It was blue, and it was showing little blue fibers in each sample. And they cross-referenced the fibers in these samples to that carpet and found that he was sampling in his office.
Money.
So that's a clip from the NPR CPI investigative series, Black Lung, returns to coal country. And so this inspector is admitting that he knew that the sample was being tampered with.
Well, in that particular case, that was more an example of the kinds of things that were being done then and really have continued. But in that particular case, that mining official was prosecuted. He actually went to jail. And there have been 100 cases through 2002 of federal prosecution for bogus mine sampling, and people have gone to jail or been put on probation, or companies paid about $2 million in fines. What's not clear is whether or not there have been any attempts to prosecute since then. At least the Mine Safety and Health Administration won't tell us whether or not they referred any cases of mine dust sampling fraud to the Justice Department for prosecution since 2002. They gave us very detailed information about what happened until 2002. We don't know what's happened since. We do know that the agency has launched what it's called a Dustbusters program, and it sent mine inspectors into targeted mines, and in about 90 or so inspections, they found more than 500 coal dust violations in the last 3 years. And many, many miners that we've spoken with, as recently, one on the record as recently, he worked in underground as recently as 4 years ago. But almost every miner I've spoken with in the last 2 years while working on the Upper Big Branch investigation that we've been conducting, they all say that what typically happens is that the device used for sampling coal dust is, you know, put in the mine office, like we just heard, or it's tucked into a lunchbox, or it's hung out in a clean air return away from the coal dust, or it's only worn for a portion of the shift. And legally, you know, they only have to wear it for 8 hours during a shift, but they work typically more like 10 hours a day. So there's both legal ways to measure the sampling, and there's this gaming of the system that the Mine Safety and Health Administration has known about from the very beginning. There were attempts to control it, but it has continued, and it continues to today based on what we've heard from many coal miners we've spoken with, former mine inspectors, former mine officials, current mine agency officials. Hmm. So it's a system that is ripe for abuse.
Chris Hamby, so it is ripe for abuse. You have these mining companies self-reporting and employees doing the collecting, and you have in the NPR story a couple of miners who say, you know, if I didn't do this, I would be out of a job. I mean, it's my work on the line. Is there any indication that the system will change to allow the federal inspectors, you know, those who don't have a conflict of interest, to go in and do the testing themselves? Chris Hamby?
Yeah, well, I should note that there are also currently the federal inspectors do conduct some samples, but again, there are lots of ways to beat that. Rules only require a mine to be running at 50% production during the sampling. And there are various other ways. You know, they always have the ventilation done right, we've heard from miners. I mean, what's happening when an inspector is there is in no way reflective of the conditions that a miner is normally facing. So there is a proposal that MSHA put out in 2010 that would introduce sampling devices that would essentially give you a real-time monitor. They would require you to be sampling at full production. So they would close a lot of the loopholes, but the rule itself would still leave much of the sampling responsibility in the hands of the coal companies themselves, which a lot of people see as a serious problem with the rule.
Mm. Even the coal companies don't want that. The mining industry has called for sampling, compliance sampling, only done by the Mine Safety and Health Administration.
So is it a money issue? What is it?
Well, what MSHA says when we ask that question is that it's a resource issue, it's a money issue, it's a staffing issue. And basically they say they don't have the ability to do that.
What about, I mean, the goal here is to protect miners' health. Can technology help us in that regard? Are there new masks that miners can wear, or respirators, or some kind of tool that would protect miners who spend extended periods of time in this really toxic environment? Howard Berkus?
Well, so far, there are respirators, but there have been problems with using respirators. Miners talk about how the respirators get clogged with coal dust, and then it's difficult to breathe through them. And you have to take the respirator off to change the filter. Well, you're supposed to be running the mining machine. It hurts production if you do that. So some miners have tried to wear respirators, some don't. Some miners, hundreds of miners, are suing the manufacturers of respirators, claiming that their illness, their black lung, was caused by ineffective respirators. So there's some question about whether the respirators that are out there are of much use anyway. Plus, you're in an environment where you have to communicate with people, and you're operating these massive mining machines that are very noisy, and you need to be free to communicate, and a respirator kind of blocks that. There has been some use of what are called Airstream helmets, a helmet that will push fresh air over your head and out down across your face, and there's a shield in front of your face, a clear shield, and those are effective for keeping dust away from your mouth, but some miners have complained about those visibility issues, and some just don't see them. They're not available to them. There are questions about whether that is something that would really work all the time. But the bottom line is that the law requires that control of coal dust be done not by technological means, but by how you operate the mine. So if you need, you got to make sure you have enough ventilation. You have to make sure that there's enough water sprayed where you're cutting coal. So that helps tamper down the coal dust. You need to make sure that if there's too much coal dust, you have to slow down the mining machine so it's not generating as much. These are things that hurt production. So there's a tension there. And there's something else that we've picked up on, which is that there's a sort of macho kind of bravado among coal miners. So some of them wouldn't be caught dead wearing a respirator or a helmet.
I'm going in.
This is my job. But we have talked to miners who tried to use those items and found them difficult or ineffective for one reason or another. The law requires that you prevent the exposure at the coal face, not by means of technology, but otherwise. And there is work being done to create better technology. But right now, it's a matter of, as one miner said to us, if they want to operate cleanly, they can. And so far, in his case, this was Mark McCowan, they haven't. He said it hasn't worked out too well for us, the miners.
It's interesting when you say that the argument among federal regulators is, we don't have the resources to do what we need to do, and so we have to rely on the company doing these samples. And yet there's this really staggering statistic that you both bring out on compensation for people who have contracted black lung disease. I mean, it's in the billions, Chris Hamby.
It is, and this is, I don't know if there's been any sort of a cost-benefit analysis of that, but, in the proposal for the new rule that MSHA issued, the proposal in 2010, it would actually, by their calculations, it would come out saving money in the long run to implement these dust controls, certainly a lot of people have, gone through the black lung compensation system, and it is not a pleasant thing for a miner to go through. And that was perhaps more than almost anything. A lot of the conversations with miners end up coming back to the compensation system, how difficult it is to actually win, how coal companies routinely appeal cases, how they have to litigate against experienced firms for prolonged periods of time. And, it's just really one of the primary concerns of most miners we talk to.
And so the number is $45
billion.
That's how much the federal government and the industry have spent on compensating coal miners and their families for black lung since 1970. There are about 57,000 people receiving black lung benefits, at least there were in 2011. So you're right, this is this huge expense. But I think what happens here is that mining companies weigh what may be a future expense against losing production today. Mm. There's this pressure to produce, especially when you don't know whether there's going to be the demand for coal next week or next month. And we've actually seen a retraction in coal demand in the last few months, major layoffs in the coal fields in Appalachia. But, you know, 6 months ago or a year ago, it was a booming industry. So what they're getting while the getting's good, and if they have to pay later, they pay later. That apparently is the attitude, because you think that a $45 billion bill that you're going to incur would discourage this kind of exposure of coal dust but with coal miners.
Mm-hmm. Black lung cases are up across the country, particularly in Appalachia, but there are cases here in Utah. Howard, what's the extent here?
I actually didn't look at the data before I came here on Utah. I should have anticipated that question. But I know, generally speaking, that this is a phenomenon that's particularly acute in Appalachia and in portions of West Virginia, Virginia, and Kentucky, in part because of the silica mixed in the coal seams, in part because of the type of coal that is mined there. So as you look across the country, and we do have this data, and what I'll do is I'll provide you a document that you can post on your website.
Perfect.
And people can, in Utah, can look county by county what the coal exposure rates are, what the black lung occurrences are. So we'll have that on the website later today. But generally, in the West, this is a lesser phenomenon. And really, there are some counties in which the black lung rate has actually declined. But the most serious problem that we're seeing is in Appalachia.
We've only got a couple minutes left. Chris Hamby, you and Howard have been working on this series for the better part of a year. What kind of response are you getting from this investigative report so far?
Well, we haven't heard a whole lot so far.
I guess it just came out yesterday, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's more just from a lot of people that we know who are interested in public health issues, saying, you know, thanks for bringing this to light.
What kind of response are you hoping to get?
Well, we just hope that this information gets out there and that people are aware of, you know, what's happening, especially in Appalachia, and also information about the proposed rule that's on the table right now. And IMSHA is desperately trying to push that rule out the door, but it's unclear whether anything will happen in this election year. And then, of course, attempts at reform twice before have failed because of a change in administrations.
Mm. Howard Berkus.
Yeah, I just want to add to that particularly silent so far are members of Congress who have been particularly silent in the last 2 years since the Upper Big Branch mine disaster. And we got to look at one of the autopsies from that mine disaster, a 33-year-old miner who died, Gary Wayne Quarles, showing that he had black lung after only 15, 17 years underground. And what that says is that if the coal dust that hadn't killed him in that explosion, it might have ended up killing him with black lung. And there has been a noticeable silence from members of Congress, no breastbeating, no calling of hearings in which people are brought to account, no demanding of change from the Mine Safety and Health Administration in any meaningful way, no legislation that has gotten through in a Congress that was Democratic in the Senate and the House when this mine disaster happened, in a Congress that has been split since. Nothing has happened with that. I don't have much confidence that anything will happen as a result of the stories we've done on black lung, because there just is not the call out there. People just don't seem to care about coal miners dying from this disease. 70,000 of them since 1970, more people are dying from black lung than in mine disasters. So maybe I'm a little cynical at this stage. We're not hearing a whole lot so far from people who could actually make a difference.
NPR's rural affairs correspondent Howard Burke is joining me here in studio. And Howard, thanks very much for your time.
Great for having me.
Chris Hamby, a staff writer for iWatchNews.org at the Center for Public Integrity, joining us from NPR in Washington. Chris, thanks to you as well.
Thank you for having me.
And again, there will be links to the entire NPR CPI investigative series on our website, kcpw.org. Coming up next, singer-songwriter Jay Henderson. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce, and this is City Views. Singer-songwriter Jay Henderson grew up listening to punk. Is that right?
I grew up listening to everything, I guess.
While his own work as a musician captures the intensity of that tradition, he certainly embraces a quieter approach in his music today. Today on the program, Henderson joins us to talk about striking out on his own, his time as frontman for Band of Annuals, and his new release, The Sun Will Burn Our Eyes. Jay Henderson joins me in studio. Thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, good thanks morning. For having me.
Jay Henderson is the former frontman for the Band of Annuals, arguably one of Salt Lake's most successful bands. He's known for carefully crafting songs, and he's now out on his own with a more stripped-down texture for his new release, The Sun Will Burn Our Eyes. And we'll give you links and details on our website, kcpw.org. Jay Henderson is the featured artist for July on KCPW Sounds from the Lounge, which you can find on our website, kcpw.org. And he'll be playing next Tuesday, July 17th, at the Urban Lounge here in Salt Lake City. If you've got questions or comments for Jay about his unique sound or inspiration for his songs, give us a call, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Jay, it's great to have you here. Give us your musical bio, where you grew up, and your education in music.
Oh, my bio. Oh, boy. I was born and raised here, so I've been here pretty much all my life. I went to Orlando for a while and studied to be an engineer and then came back, and it's just been in me forever. That's all I can say. I've just been doing it as long as I can remember.
From engineering to music, how did you make that decision?
It seems like it went hand in hand. It was just part of it. It seemed to make sense to me.
How'd you end up playing the guitar?
Let's see. Well, my father played guitar. My parents have played music since I was little. So I just picked it up from him just one day, felt like I wanted to be like dad, So picked up the guitar and that was that. And taught me three chords and just ran with it.
So this listening to punk, but other forms of music, which groups in particular were you drawn to?
Oh, man, I just too many. The list goes on and on. I mean, I guess when we're young, we all start off on some sort of punk, right? Something more rebellious. And then it just kind of petered into really being interested in a lot of folk and a lot of country and a lot of things like that. Just a lot more roots music just seemed to resonate with me stronger. So I've been doing that for, I don't know, 10 years, 15 years.
Is that how would you characterize your style today? Folky, rock?
Folk-ish, minimalist folk. I don't know, something like that. It's all, what can you say? It's all been done at this point. So it's something along those lines.
You played with one of Utah's most well-known, successful local bands, Band of Annuals, until a couple of years ago when a couple of band members moved out of state, mm-hmm. I understand. Why did you decide to strike out on your own instead of finding another collaboration, another group to jam with?
It just kind of fell into it that way, Like we had a great run, and I miss playing with those guys a lot, but it was, we were road warriors and we got tired and everybody had bills to pay and we had things that we had to get, get going again. And so it was just easier for me to do it by myself without trying to take five other people and me on the road. It just gets too pricey. It's too hard to do now. So mm-hmm. It seemed like the most logical step.
Has being on your own changed the tone or the content of the music that you put out now? I mean, is it different in any way?
It's slightly different. I mean, it's kind of the same thing, but not playing with those guys and having them help mold the songs has definitely changed it, you know. So when I, you know, I brought in Blake Henderson to help me produce this record, and so, you know, things will obviously be different working with different people. So it's similar, but it definitely has a different vibe to it.
As I mentioned, you are the featured artist on this month's Sounds from the Lounge. We're thrilled to have you, by the way. Mm-hmm. And the first track that is up on the website is titled All Your Demons. Before I play it, tell our listeners what it's about.
What it's about? Oh, see, I have this weird thing that I always do this when someone asks me. I usually don't like to say what the songs are about because I think it's more important. It's less important what it's about to me. It's more important what it's about to them. And I have experiences where I'll have a song that I love and I'll hear an interview and someone will tell me what it's about and I'll be like, well, that sucks. That's
that
not what
ruined
I thought it,
for it
was
you.
About. Yeah. So I try to keep that a clean slate.
All right. Well, let's take a listen. This is All of Your Demons by Jay Henderson.
Tell what used to mean something to you before you let it die. You saw that letter and you hid it well, but someone here too, just if I. Makes no difference, does it, dear? When you've got nothing in your skies, and as hard as you've tried to leave it alone, certainly came back to your eyes.
Jay Henderson, that's beautiful. What's it like performing in the KCPW Member Lounge?
It's fun. Got Jesse in there to help out on everything. It's nice. It's
how are the acoustics?
They're actually really well. Like, they're really nice. I was expecting them to not be as good as they are.
Speaking with Jay Henderson, a singer-songwriter here in Salt Lake City. He'll be playing at the Urban Lounge on next Tuesday, July 17th, here in Salt Lake City. He's also our featured artist at kcpw.org. In addition to your very lovely acoustic sound, there's something that's a little bit more produced on your website. This is the title track from your new release. Tell us about some of the songs on this new release, The Sun Will Burn Our Eyes.
Oh man, there's it's just a handful of songs that I've been working on, I don't know, 4 years, and I kind of just threw away all the stuff that I didn't like. I made a really short record, you know, so two of the songs are the same, different versions, but the same song, and I just wanted to make something really elegant and sweet that was more refined and, you know, less filler for me, so.
And who are you singing with on this?
Sonia Cotton I'm singing with on the majority of the record, and she's fantastic. She's from San Francisco. I recommend you, everyone, go check her out.
Let's take a short listen to this. This is The Sun Will Burn Our Eyes by Jay Henderson. Maybe.
Thank you. where you going? Are you waiting for your love to start showing?
That's Jay Henderson, a new track from The Sun Will Burn Our Eyes. That's actually Lonely Man. Jay will be performing next Tuesday at the Urban Lounge in Salt Lake City. And Jay, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
City View is a production of KCPW News. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce.